You're listening to Raphael Epstein.
And this time every Friday we talk film with Josh Nelson, who joins us. Hi there, Josh.
Pleasure to be back.
Josh's film blog you can check out at filmology.com. It starts with a PH, filmology.com. Now, Josh and I have both seen Cloud Atlas. The people who brought you the Matrix films, they were the Wachowski brothers. There's an interesting story behind the fact they're now the Wachowski siblings. Fascinating story, actually. It's an amazing book. It was shortlisted for the Booker Prize by a British man called David Mitchell. It's a story within a story within a story. Now, if you've ever read If on a Winter's Night, a Traveller by Italo Calvino, if you ever do a 20th century literature course at university, it's the classic postmodern tale where you start reading a story and something like the character inside the story is reading a book, and inside that book is the story, and it keeps devolving in and in and in, and then it steps out and steps out and steps out. If you understand what I mean, there's another book written actually by the authors of The Gruffalo called Charlie Cook's book, and that too is the story within the story. Anyway, those books are quite simple in comparison to the film Cloud Atlas. It stars people like Halle Berry and Tom Hanks, but they've made some interesting structural decisions. Have a little listen to the trailer for Cloud Atlas.
Yesterday, my life was headed in one direction. Today, it is headed in another.
You ever think the universe is against you?
Fear. Belief. Love. Phenomena that determine the course of our lives. These forces begin long before we are born and continue after we perish.
That is the trailer for Cloud Atlas. Now, it's not a simple film to describe. It did come out around October. You'll have noticed it got zero Oscar nominations. There are reasons for that, but I'd love to hear from you. Films that are all style and no substance. 1300 222 774. Josh, before we attack the film in a positive or negative way, describe the film.
Okay, I think your allusion there to the book is an important one, because I actually started reading David Mitchell's novel and was loving it. And unfortunately, I think I've contaminated that reading by watching the film. I think there's more approaches to this film than just the idea of adaptation, but because of the structure is so important to both Mitchell's work and the film, I think it's worth pointing out sort of some of the differences. Mitchell's work is basically six stories that the first five go up to a halfway point, one after the other in succession. The sixth story plays out in its entirety, and then we go in reverse order. So we get the finish of the fifth, the fourth, and so on. So the book ends with the end of the first story. So it's almost a V-shaped narrative.
There are common themes,
yeah, definitely,
and the odd allusion to similarities in the book, aren't there? So, and they're set in different times, different places, different worlds, but there's common themes.
Yeah, the stories are quite distinct. You have a sort of a 1700 seafaring tale. You have a story about a composer set in the pre-sort of World War II era. You have a 1960s espionage tale. You have a kind of contemporary era story that revolves around a publisher. And then you have two futuristic stories, one in a sort of a near future, which is a neo-Korea sort of Blade Runner-esque society. And then the super future, the distant future, in which sort of society has reverted to a kind of semi-primal state and all speak in a kind of a pidgin English. So diverse genres, diverse time periods, you know, the book, I think, even just from my limited experience with it, was alluding to connections. My problem with the film, and why I would dispute the fact that it's an ambitious film, in as much as I think every film is ambitious to a degree, it's hard to get a film off the ground, but it simplifies those connections down to a point where it beats you over the head with it. I mean, it opens with the far-flung future story where we have a heavily made-up Tom Hanks in his pidgin English that sounds scarily like Jar Jar Binks saying, "You sir, me sir, all connected, sir." And this is the idea that all people are connected is made so obvious from the get-go, and it just is so so unsubtle about the way in which it then every scene it sort of reinforces this idea. And I think there was some subtleties in the book that you don't obviously get here. And that's, I think, one of the kind of key points that really started to frustrate me from the get-go, because the structure of the film is not six interdependent stories weaving in a V-shaped pattern. It's cross-cutting throughout the entire
thing. It's
totally
random, isn't it? You get 30 seconds of one story, then a complete jump cut to 2 minutes of the next story, and then 6 minutes of the next, and There were many moments in the film where I thought, oh, I've actually got no idea what's going on.
See, I actually thought there was simplicity in the editing as well. Mitchell's keeping the story separate in Mitchell's work puts the onus back on the reader or the audience to make those connections. But here, the editing is all thematic. So, you know, you get one story about love or a moment of love or someone's death, and then you cut to another story about death. So even in those connections, it's basically patent hand-holding for the audience. And the other thing which I thought was a bit clumsy was that the casting. They've cast the same actors in these different scenarios, even crossing race and gender divides, and maybe we'll get onto some of those issues in a moment. But, you know, the cast of predominantly Tom Hanks, Halle Berry, Hugo Weaving, Hugh Grant, Jim Broadbent, and Ben Whishaw repeat. So even in those individual stories, you have characters playing the same character type. Yeah. So there's no real work for the audience to do. And at 3 hours, for someone telling you the same thing, which is basically at its most base, everyone's connected, and look at how history repeats itself, and we never learn from our mistakes. It just wore me down, and I found it really frustrating because I felt it wasn't giving me anything anywhere to go.
Well, there's something about the subtlety and nuance of the book that leads you not to a higher truth, but to a greater explanation and exploration of the world. And unfortunately, with the makeup and the simplification, and I think one of the key flaws in the book, the odd character could potentially be not a reincarnation, but another version of someone in a different time and in a different place hundreds of years ago. The film is replete with the same person playing a multitude of different characters, and I agree that it's all the subtlety and nuance goes out the window.
And I have to say that also raises issues in terms of the performances, because you have Tom Hanks, I think he plays one American role in this, which is his standout character, really. But then you've got him playing Irish, Cockney, you know, and it's not helped by some pretty ordinary makeup and special
effects. The makeup's terrible, isn't it?
You know those costume shops where you have people dressing up as Austin Powers and they buy those fake teeth?
Yes.
It's like watching that, and the actors can't actually deliver their lines. So the makeup is not conducive to the storyline. In fact, it actually works against it in a number of cases.
And one of the Hugh Grant performances, his makeup is so bad and so full that he can't actually form any expressions. It's kind of like all his lips and his eyes are moving beneath a mask. I thought that was particularly poor.
Yeah, they've used I think a silicone makeup for some of the full prosthetics, and you limit the range of movement. Whereas with a foam latex, this is getting far technical. We don't need to go there, but you know there is some major problems, and with the facial work as well. And look, I know that the filmmakers really struggled to get this film up off the ground. It was a number of attempts. Studios wouldn't have a bar of it, and it was really only through Tom Hanks that the film got up. So you kind of admire that to a degree, but for me, the final product just didn't wash.
Look, I'd love to hear from you. Films that are exceptionally, well, not so much ambitious, but they're so busy worrying about the style that they really fail. 1300-222-774. There's a text here, style over substance, try Australia. I'd think you could put most Baz Luhrmann films there, but forgive me. Chris has called from Pakenham with a style over substance selection. Yes, Chris?
It looks really, really good, this movie, Prometheus.
Ah, yes.
But it's one of the silliest films I've ever seen. It's just the plot line and the reasons for people being in the show are just...
It started well. Prometheus started well. It just kind of went downhill as it went.
It's a good plot. It could have been a great, great movie, but it just got sillier and sillier. You know, the self-abortion and the the whole.
Actually, I was kind of with it, Chris, at the self-abortion. It was kind of after that for me it fell over.
That should have been the climax. That should have been the climactic moment of the film.
If only they let Josh edit these films.
I know.
Someone's sent in a text on 0437-774-774. People forget that The Blues Brothers was a flop. Don't write off a movie just because it does no good. It might just become a classic. I don't think Cloud Atlas is going to be that. I suppose I would like to be proven wrong, because I have to say, Josh, I did want it to work. I was kind of cheering. I was thinking, no, surely they will resolve this. Surely they can take it to the level.
Well, this is
no
Blues Brothers was actually a good film. It's not because it hasn't done money that we're disliking this film. It's because it's actually problematic. And look, I did want to touch on the issue of the yellow face in terms of the makeup, because I think, even though I don't think this film is setting out to be offensive by dressing up Hugh Grant and others with the slanty eyes and with the prosthetic Asian makeup, I think you can't just overlook a history of kind of poor representations.
Yes.
It's like blackface. It has a pretty insidious kind of past. And I think that was one of the things they could have just avoided if they hadn't gone with the necessity of casting casting the same people in every segment.
It was, and it was just a bit weird, wasn't it? All these quite obviously European people being made to look Asian. It just, I don't know, it just didn't work. 1300 222 774. Ooh, someone's texted in, Avatar is all style, no substance.
Yep, I'll second that nomination.
I loved Avatar, but that's just me. Jeremy, the style perhaps won me over. I thought Avatar was extraordinary. But Jeremy's called in from Moorabbin. Hey, Jeremy.
G'day.
What's your nomination?
I'd just throw in virtually any post-apocalyptic movie ever made.
That's harsh.
There's been one or two good ones.
28 Days Later was okay.
Yeah, there's one.
Yep.
But then you tried to do a sequel to it, and it just ended up...
Oh, that was terrible.
Oh, yep. So there's the odd gem in your post-apocalyptic films, but usually they disappoint. I'm thinking Kevin Costner films particularly.
Oh, Waterworld's its own genre. That's okay. But I loved The Boat in Waterworld.
What about
The
Postman?
Wow. Oh, The Postman, another Kevin Costner gem. And hold on, Jeremy, what about The Road? That sort of got mixed reviews. Did you like that as a film?
Yeah, I didn't actually get to see The Road. I think it's because I've been turned off by these post-apocalyptic films that promise everything and don't deliver.
Yes.
And I saw a preview to The Road and thought I was just another one of those and didn't actually bother with it. So maybe I should.
Look, it's not bad, Jeremy.
Can I recommend a post-apocalyptic film?
Yes, please.
This is a film that passed under the radar last year. It only got a DVD release. It's a German film called Hell, and it's amazing. It's probably the best kind of low-budget film that works to its limitations. Really smart. It's basically the Earth has heated up to a point where people can't go out in the sun.
Right.
And it's almost like The Road. It's sort of bands of scavengers. Look out for it. Hell. Really great film.
Hell, a German film. And... Quiet Earth, the Bruno Lawrence film from decades ago.
On 774 ABC Melbourne, you're listening to Raphael Epstein.
Some good texts here on style over substance. The Royal Tenenbaums and Inception are the most overstyled and lack of substance. Disagree on the first, agree on the second. Josh, tell me a little bit more about what you thought was wrong with the film. It's quite it's a huge project. They've obviously sent people all over the world. Some parts of it are spectacularly beautiful. Why didn't it work?
Well, I think the other reason, and maybe this gets back to style, so not to sound like a broken record, but the different genres and the different styles of storytelling in Mitchell's work, I think, function next to each other because there's that degree of separation. Mm. Whereas here you're switching between tonally different genres and visually different genres as well. So, you know, there's one of the stories with Jim Broadbent where he gets locked up in an old person's home and they play it completely slapstick. I mean, it's over the top. It's, you know, it's like 70s British sitcom. And then suddenly you leap to quite serious espionage, people getting murdered and then, you know, there's sort of assault in the future. And I think that the butting up of these different genres and this complete tonal inconsistency that comes from that, it really leaves the film with a hard place to go, because I think you need to have a fairly deft touch if you're going to balance those genres. And I don't think the Wachowskis have it. I think they have a distinct visual style, and I think, you know, they clearly love the idea of visual effects through films like Matrix and Speed Racer. But for me, I don't think they've ever topped their first film, which was Bound. Yeah. I think Bound is a stunning and a really polished sort of film.
Yeah, it's kind of like a blancmange that doesn't work. But I will put in a good word for Ben Whishaw. Freddie from The Hour has a role. He and his gay lover, I can't remember the man he has a relationship with, but I actually found Ben Whishaw's scenes very good, and he has some scenes with Jim Broadbent. I did think they stood out. They were quite strong.
And it plays to both their strengths as actors with their own accents.
Well, that too, and that without too much makeup as well. Yes, indeed. But look, films that are all style and no substance. Someone with a little bit of support for the people who made Cloud Atlas has this text. The first Matrix film had such a great message that we live in a parallel universe of mass consumerism and instant gratification. Most people that I mention this message to don't get it, though. Maybe that's part of
it. It's not particularly subtle in that film either.
No, it isn't. I'm hoping you do kind of get that when you're watching The Matrix. Wow, really? Whoever texted that in? Maybe you need to chat who you're talking to films about. Mark has called in from Werribee. Mark, have you got a film that's all style, no substance?
I reckon the film Soylent Green. Yeah, Raph, 2 days in a row, I can't believe I'm ringing you.
Well, I'm trying to keep it. We did have a post-apocalyptic discussion yesterday, but that was fiction. So you can go post-apocalyptic, but we are trying to talk about style and substance.
I realise that. There's a film called Soylent Green, which starred Charlton Heston.
Yes.
That was actually looked very much, it was incredibly stylistically shot, although it did have a little tiny bit of substance to it. It was based on a book, I think, by Ray Bradbury called Make Room, Make Room.
It's Harry Harrison, I think, but I'm
Harry
not sure.
Harry Harrison, okay, no worries. Where the human race eventually begins eating itself.
Yes, which is referenced, which is referenced in Cloud Atlas. Look, Mark, I would agree with that nomination. Actually, it's been a while since I've seen it, but yes, Someone's got a good text. Ken in Caulfield suggesting, of course, Dune. Terrible film of a fantastic book. And I do think when Dune came out, it actually was reasonably stylish, and it was reasonably ambitious, but it's a terrible film.
It's a beautiful looking film, but even David Lynch has now disowned that film. I mean, the studio
is
so much.
I didn't realize
they recut it, and he refused to put his name on it, so it became an Alan Smithy film. I actually have a nomination for one that I actually like, in spite of the fact that it has no substance, and that's Zack Snyder's 300, which I know is politically incorrect, ideologically corrupt,
but fairly spectacular,
but stunning in terms of its visuals, and it's a whole lot of fun if you like the sort of hysterical, oiled up, you know.
Won't even get into that conversation, Josh. Look, it's coming up to 8 minutes to 5 o'clock, 774 ABC Melbourne. Josh Nelson is here. His blog is called filmology.com, where that starts with a PH. My name's Raphael Epstein. We've got another film to have a look at. It's called The Imposter. Keep your calls coming through, though, on films that are just a triumph of looks with no brains. 1300 222 774. But have a little listen to the trailer for The Imposter.
There was something going on more than meets the eye, of course.
He couldn't speak English without an accent.
Maybe it's not Nicholas Barclay.
He cannot be an American.
We didn't need to prove who he was.
This is their family member. I mean, no one would be wrong about something like that.
Wait a minute.
There you go. That's The Imposter. Josh, tell me what it's about.
It's a documentary. This is a really remarkable film. I'm quite happy about this one. It's directed by Bart Layton, who's done mostly documentaries for television in the past. But this is a documentary that's stylish with substance. It reminded me a lot of Errol Morris-style documentaries, the guy who did the Fog of War, The Thin Blue Line, Tabloid. And one of the characteristics I think that's similar between Morris's films and this style of documentary is the intimate form of camera work, where the participants look directly into the camera. And the story for this is quite remarkable too, because you have a young child who disappears in San Antonio in 1994, and then apparently turns up 3 years later in Spain, but as you just heard in the trailer, has a French accent, doesn't look the same, and has different eye colours, and yet still gets, you know, deported or relocated to the US, to the family.
It sounds very odd, the premise of this.
It's a remarkable story. It's almost that one that if it wasn't true, you wouldn't believe it. But the funny thing is that the dramatic drive of this documentary is not whether or not this character is Nicholas Barclay, the teen who disappeared, because the film's called The Imposter, and we hear from Frederick Bourdain, who's from the start of the documentary, who's the guy who was impersonating this young child. What the documentary really teases out is the kind of psychological mechanisms and the questions that it raises, whether this guy, Frederick Bourdain, who performs this role of the imposter, whether he's performing out of some sort of desperation of a childhood he'd never had and a trauma and wanting to kind of latch onto this family, and whether he's a serial impersonator. And what is it that did the family really not recognize that this was their child, or are they hiding? Is there an ulterior motive? And as the film progresses, it becomes incredibly tense and it starts to take on some sort of sinister turns. But you have full access to all the family members in terms of interviews. Then you have the other level of the institutional values. So the spokespeople from the CIA saying, wow, it's pretty difficult to get a passport to America. How did someone who doesn't look the same, is clearly older, he has facial hair and he's supposed to be 14? This is... this becomes
an odd.
It's a fascinating documentary and really stylishly put together. A lot of the work is done through reenactments and interviews, and the reenactments are quite nicely sort of put together as well. But you get this fascinating, almost mutually supportive kind of delusion or fantasy played out between the imposter character and the family. And, you know, you start to kind of question at what point does the fantasy break. And, you know, what I found fascinating was the way in which this Bourdain character starts talking about, you know, he'd realized he'd gone too far, that he's impersonated people before, but he wasn't just impersonating now. He'd actually stolen someone's identity, and suddenly there was all these other kind of moral issues that it was raising that he hadn't experienced in the past. Yeah, really fascinating documentary. It's on fairly limited release, but this is one well worth checking out.
Okay. The Imposter is the name of the film. Do you know where it's on?
It's on probably sort of the non-multiplex cinemas, Palace, Como, Nova, those sort of ones.
People are texting in lots of different things. John Carter is a film that's all style, no substance. And someone keeps on texting in that I'll read this one out straight and embarrass Josh. Hi, Josh. He was my tutor lecturer at uni in film class. I had a major crush on him. Film geek chic. I can't watch Death Proof without thinking of Josh. So there you go. He's made an impression, at least on some of us. Let's
Do you have
in.
A name with that?
No names, and I will not give you the phone number. Nick's called from Roeville. Hi, Nick. What's your style over substance tip?
Oh, g'day, guys. Look, the best way to fill your list, Ralph, is to take any movie that's been nominated for an Oscar for cinematography and nothing else.
Oh, have you got one? I don't know. Have you got any examples?
Well, I've got one, yeah. Mine is going back a bit, but I reckon Ryan's Daughter would be in that category.
I don't even remember it. You know, I mean, I remember it, but I don't remember watching it.
Yeah, shot in 70mm in Ireland, beautiful scenery and everything else, but I'm afraid the story fizzled.
Okay, look, that's a good tip, Nick. That's a very sensible tip. Check out the one that's only nominated for a cinematography Oscar. Beautiful. Thank you, Josh.
Pleasure as always.
Josh Nelson's blog is called filmology.com. That starts with a PH.